This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
You are an old man who thinks in terms of nations and peoples. There are no nations. There are no peoples. There is only one holistic system of systems. One vast and immane, interwoven, interacting, multivariate, multinational dominion of dollars. And you have meddled with the primal forces of nature. And you will atone.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Live from Toronto, Canada, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Everybody knows that the
do not adjust your dial. You have arrived at the right place. 7 months later, mind you, sort of a time warp, isn't it? Since I was last heard on the airwaves here in Toronto the Good. Now, where was I before I was so rudely interrupted? Ah, yes, we will, of course, talk about President Barack Obama because the rumors persist that that's the reason I was turfed from another radio station. I was paying a little too much attention to that whole question about Barack Obama's legitimacy or illegitimacy in terms of his eligibility to be president. Is there an imposter in the White House? I'll discuss that in a few moments. Let me give you a heads up. What's coming up on the maiden voyage of the Conspiracy Show. And let me, first of all, thank some people. Not the Academy Awards, but I am very, very appreciative and grateful to everyone here at AM 740. They've been very welcoming. But in particular, I want to thank Gene Stevens, who really went to bat for me and for this program and fought to get this show on the air. Also to George Grant, General Manager, President, and Moses Neimer, who have all, as I say, been very supportive. And I look forward to a very long tenure here. The moment I stepped in the building at 550 Queen Street East, it felt like home. And I'm so happy to be back on the air and delivering the news and the stories that a lot of others in the mainstream media simply choose to ignore. Let me introduce someone else in the other studio. Dan the Grassy Knoll Ellison is flying this ship and holding my hand and keeping me in line. And I look forward to a long working relationship with Dan. All right, coming up in the program, in the second hour, the swine flu. Something wicked this way comes. But is this the big one? Is this the pandemic that everyone has been warning us was going to wash ashore, that it was inevitable? Every 20 years, we have another pandemic? Or is this some type of New World Order psychological warfare being perpetrated against us sheeple? We'll find out when Dr. Len Horowitz and Dr. Patricia Doyle, the lab gal, joins me in the second hour. August 16th, 1977. I don't have to tell you what that means, of course. 32 years later, the rumor persists that Elvis has not, in fact, left the building. Now, I realize that this whole conversation for many of you has sort of entered into the realm of schlockdom. Oh, not another Elvis is alive story. Well, wait till you hear what my guest at the bottom of the hour has to say will reach Eliza Alice Presley in Graceland, or at Graceland, where she's attending the candlelight vigil. She says she has DNA evidence that she is, in fact, the half-sister of Elvis. She is the daughter of Elvis's father, Vernon Presley, who passed away in 1979. But further, she says she has DNA evidence that Elvis is, in fact, still alive. Evidence, DNA evidence. You heard me correctly. This has people down in Memphis scratching their heads because in late 2008, a Tennessee judge actually reopened the Vernon Presley estate. So impressed was he by this DNA evidence. All right, that's all up and coming on the program. Now, as I mentioned, President Barack Obama. No doubt you've heard the rumor mill. He's not eligible to be president because he's not a natural U.S.-born citizen. His paternal grandmother has sworn up and down several times she attended his birth in a hospital in Kenya in 1961. Hold on, says the state authorities in Hawaii. We've seen the long-form birth certificate, and the president and present occupant of the White House was indeed born in Hawaii. Except we can't find it. So we'll post this electronic version online. Except some forensic investigators have taken a look at that electronic version and said that's clearly a forgery. It just won't die. There are rumors that I was let go from my previous job at another radio station because I wouldn't let this story die, and I continued to hammer away at this issue, and I probably conducted no fewer than 7 or 8 interviews with my next guest, who will join me here shortly. Philip Berg has really been spearheading this whole campaign to force the president to prove he is eligible to be president, that he is in fact a natural-born U.S. citizen. He is the former Deputy Attorney General of Pennsylvania. He is an attorney. He is no tinfoil hat-wearing kook, ladies and gentlemen, and I will speak to him when we come back.
When in doubt, blame the government. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Joining me on the line is, as I mentioned, the former Deputy Attorney General of Pennsylvania, Attorney Phil Berg. Phil, good to talk to you again.
My pleasure. How are you, sir?
I'm well, thank you. I don't know if you heard the preamble. I'm not sure if you were aware. You may have gotten me fired.
I did hear that. I hope not. Maybe we'll turn around. We can still sue them. But, you know, there's a thing called free speech, right?
That's all right. I wear it as a badge of honor, if in fact that's what happened, but who knows? Anyway, listen. Again, the rumors, they're not rumors. There is considerable evidence to support the fact, to support the allegation, rather, that the current occupant of the White House is not a natural-born U.S. citizen. Now, the latest, of course, is this document that supposedly is a long-form birth certificate or a birth registration from Kenya. But there are many that have dismissed that as a forgery. What are your thoughts on that document?
Excuse me, the latest one that was posted by an attorney, actually in a lawsuit, and on her website?
Yes.
Okay, that document is a forgery. It's a fraud. Please, no one look at that. The problem is this. We have to take a look at things. From the beginning, and I've now been involved, it's my 13th month on this, since August of 2008. Our website is obamacrimes.com, obamacrimes.com. Our website has stayed focused, directed on this topic. We have 3 lawsuits pending. Over this past year, I have received several supposed original copies of birth certificates from Kenya. What I've done with them is I've done what's called being a responsible attorney, and I've had people review them. When we reviewed them, we found out that they were not legit. Did I post them on my website? Not at all. For this one, which was posted about 2 weeks ago, it's irresponsible by the attorney. I don't even like naming her because I just don't like what she does. By posting it and then ask the court to give expedited discovery to so that they could authenticate this document.
All right,
that's not how you practice law.
No, yet we had the earlier affidavits of Barack Obama's paternal grandmother. I believe she swore out an affidavit that she attended his birth in a Mombasa hospital in 1961, and then, of course, all of a sudden, after recanting this several times, that whole side of the family simply shut up, or were made to shut up. So we've heard.
Well, I think it's made to shut up. We have on our website, ObamaCrimes.com, we have actually the in Swahili, the wording, I mean, the word of Sarah Obama stating that she was in the hospital when Obama was born. We have the translations by two ministers who are actually with her. The questions were asked her in English, translated to Swahili, and she has it back. At the end of the tape, there are some young people yelling, no, he was born in Hawaii. But that was, just trying to, they know that he was born in Kenya.
Phil Berg here on the Conspiracy Show, and he is the former Attorney General, a Deputy Attorney General of Pennsylvania, that really has been following or spearheading this campaign to have Barack Obama prove he is a natural-born U.S. citizen. Let me ask you this, because apparently there was a comment from a constitutional lawyer who says that even if there's proof Obama is not legitimate, there is a provision in American law for a judge to withhold or modify his judgment if it would cause chaos, which it probably would apply in this case if it were to come out that Barack Obama was not a natural-born U.S. citizen and thus ineligible. Your comment on that?
Well, first off, I'm shocked that a constitutional lawyer would say that. You know, the law is the law, okay? We must follow the law. You can't just... Now, when I prove legally that Obama has been putting forth the biggest hoax in the history of this country and basically lying and that he should be legally removed from office, I will call together all of the ministers in this country, all religious leaders, all political leaders for a massive news conference and saying, wait a minute, stop. What do you plan to do? You plan to riot? You plan to destroy property? You plan to injure and kill people? For what reason? One person is responsible for all this. That's Barack Obama. Really, we believe his legal name is when he was adopted in Indonesia, because if any of your listeners adopted a child, when they adopt a child, they take your last name. Again, on our website, we have his school record from Indonesia. His name is Barry Sotoro. I believe that's his name. But I would say to everyone, Barry Sotoro or Barack Obama knows what's going on. He's not a stupid person. He went to Occidental College in California, Columbia University in New York, and Harvard Law School. He graduated and practiced law. He taught constitutional law for 10 years. He knows that this is a big fraud. So stop what you're doing. The only one who should be held responsible is Obama and Michelle Obama and Howard Dean, the former head of the Democratic National Committee, the head during the time he was nominated and elected, other senior people at the Democratic National Committee, senior campaign officials, and now senior administration officials who all know this is a bald-faced lie,
all right,
should all be subjected to the criminal justice system.
Let me just say,
tried, and those convicted should go to jail.
Let me say, for the record, and I've said this a number of times just to clarify, and I'll say it
sure,
again,
please.
I really hope that you're wrong, and I think you hope that you're wrong, too, that he is, in fact, legitimate, correct?
Well, yeah, but here's the problem. For your listeners now, when I first filed my first lawsuit, August 21st, 2008, a year ago, I stated, and this was before the Democratic National Convention, I said, Obama, prove me wrong. Show me your long-form birth certificate that you were born in Hawaii, and I'll go away. He never showed that, which gave us time to investigate further. You're right. I'm a lifelong Democrat. But I'm doing this because more important than Democrat politics or Republican politics is our government, the Constitution, the foundation of our government. Our forefathers, really worked hard to put down together this massive, beautiful document, which has led our country become the leader in the world for the last 230 years, plus years. and the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights. Other countries have tried to copy and duplicate it, do whatever they can. They can't do it because there's too much fighting and disruption.
Hold on, Phil. Listen, we'll take a time out when we come back. Yeah. I want you to sort this out for me and for my listeners, because we're hearing from the officials of the state of Hawaii who are saying, wait a minute, no, we've seen the long-form birth certificate. It's there. We can't present it to you.
No, they didn't say that. So
okay.
When we get back, let me explain that.
Please do. All right.
Okay.
Phil Berg spearheading the campaign to force President Barack Obama to prove he deserves to be in the White House. Stay with us.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
We'll talk swine flu coming up at midnight Eastern, whether or not it is the pandemic, the big one, or some sort of psychological warfare experiment. And a young woman, she's my age, she's a young woman, down in Memphis tonight at Graceland, attending the candlelight vigil, who has, she says, DNA evidence that she is Elvis's half-sister and that he is still alive. And this is not a joke, because a Tennessee judge actually heard this case in 2008, late 2008, was impressed sufficiently with the evidence that he reopened Vernon Presley's estate. All right, Phil Berg is with us, former Deputy Attorney General of Pennsylvania, the website obamacrimes.com. And, Phil, again, sort it out. I'm hearing that the
I'll be with you 1 second. Hold on 1 second.
All right. He's about to let us in on what's going on with Hawaiian state officials who claim that they have seen Barack Obama's birth certificate, and he is, in fact, a natural-born U.S. citizen, was born in Hawaii. But, of course, that contradicts everything else we're hearing from people like Phil Berg and numerous others who have launched legal proceedings across the country. So if you're new to this, the situation is this. President Barack Obama must be, according to the Constitution, a natural-born U.S. citizen in order to be eligible to run for that office. If he was born in Kenya, then he cannot be a natural-born U.S. citizen, because it gets a little complicated, but essentially his mother was not old enough to bestow natural-born U.S. citizenship on her son. All right, Phil Berg, what are the officials in Hawaii saying about this birth certificate?
Last October 2008, they came out, this Dr. Fukino and someone else stated, we have seen his birth certificate, the long form, I think they said it was even long form of all birth certificate, and it's valid. What they didn't say it was from Hawaii. They didn't say it was from Kenya either, but they didn't specifically say it was from Hawaii. The governor came out and made a statement that these records are sealed, and as all other records, and we can't discuss those records. Just recently now, Dr. Fukino, about 2 weeks ago, comes out with a statement, and I've scrutinized the statement. She states, I've looked at the Obama's vital records. She doesn't say birth certificate. I've looked at Obama's vital records, and he is natural born. Well, first off, according to the governor, they're not allowed to comment on anything at all. So why is she suddenly commenting? Because she's trying to make a name for herself, or she's getting pressure from Obama's people. But she didn't say birth certificate. And last year she said, we've seen the birth certificate, but she didn't say where it was from. But her new statement, it says, I've seen his vital records, and he's natural born. It's baloney. You know, I mean, we're back to the same thing again. If all your listeners out there, many times now, I'm not sure in Canada, but in the United States, they must produce their birth certificate 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times in their lifetime. You need it for Little League. You need it for baptism. You need it for entrance to school. You need it definitely for a passport in the United States.
But not to register in the New Hampshire primary, apparently.
Well, maybe. I'm not sure. And there's no requirement to show a birth certificate to run for president of the United States. There's no checks and balances whatsoever. And to go hand in hand with it, why I believe that he's a phony. And hear what I'm saying, people. I'm calling this the biggest hoax in the history of our country. I'm calling Obama a phony. I'm calling him a fraud. You know, I'm sitting here, you know, I mean, they're not arresting me. They're not saying, you know, condemning me for these remarks. But think about it. Now, a legislature, a congressman from Florida has introduced legislation saying as of the year 2012, anyone running for president must prove that they're constitutionally eligible to run for office. He has 7 co-sponsors, total of 8, no Democrats. Now, why isn't everyone just jumping on that? I'll tell you why not, because they know he's not natural born, and 2012 would be the time that Obama would be running for re-election.
Why didn't the Republicans use this against Obama if they knew about this in the election?
I have no idea. But see, we have to, in the United States, in my opinion, we should, if we really want to have a better government, and we've had a fantastic government, but right now we should throw out every member of Congress, because they're in bed with each other. I mean, think about it. Obama said that his administration could be the most open, transparent administration in the history of our country. Well, how can it be transparent when he won't even acknowledge to show that he's constitutionally eligible to be president? He also said during his campaign there will never be legislation that is like basically shoved down your throat. All legislation will have at least 4 days for people to review it and comment thereon. Well, the stimulus package passed like overnight. And this new medical thing which they're trying to pass, no one really knows what it's all about. It's like 1,100 or 1,400 pages, which people who are voting for it have stated what? They've stated that they haven't read it.
Phil, aren't you shoveling sand against the tide every time somebody takes up the case and tries to get the courts to listen to them? The judge shuts it down and says, we won't hear the case. Every time.
Well, my first case, the judge shut it down and said I didn't have standing. Now, that's interesting if everyone wants to listen. He said that Phil Berg doesn't have standing, that no one in the United States has standing to question to challenge the Constitution. Now, think how absurd that is, if you think about it. First off, the 10th Amendment goes, anything else not there, goes to we the people. But the absurdity is then the judge went further, that perhaps in the future Congress will decide who should have standing to challenge the Constitution. I mean, it's so ludicrous. Now, that's the case that I took, and I bypassed the Third Circuit Court of Appeals and went to the U.S. Supreme Court asking for various injunctions, which were turned down. But the case is still alive, even though the Supreme Court has turned it down at this point. The case is alive in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals on the issue of standing, and we now have argument scheduled for Monday, October 26th, in the Third Circuit in Philadelphia. More important, I have a pressing case right now. I sued under the case was placed under seal. Now, for your listeners, people kept questioning, why is it under seal? Why is it under seal? All cases of this nature are under seal. It's called under the False Claims Act, or QUITAM, Q-U-I-T-A-M. It's usually done in Medicaid or Medicare fraud. Let me give you an example. Supposing I believe my next-door neighbor is defrauding the federal government on a Medicare claim. I would file a lawsuit against it. It would be Philip J. Berg and Philip J. Berg as relator, R-E-L-A-T-O-R, on behalf of the United States of America versus next-door neighbor. Immediately that case is sealed. It's sealed for this reason. The Department of Justice is served, the Attorney General is served, but the next-door neighbor is not served. The purpose of it is for the next 60 days the government has a chance to take a look at it and decide whether, number one, they're going to prosecute the case, number two, whether they're going to turn it over to the relator, Phil Berg, to prosecute it, or number three, whether they're going to dismiss the case. Very few cases are ever dismissed. However, in the case of mine, they decide they took a position to dismiss it. Once they dismissed it, the case became unsealed. Now, the difference is, in this case, I filed suit against Barack Obama. Actually, I decided to file the suit against Barry Soturo. I'm stating that Barack Obama is an illegal alien. Therefore, not only can he not be president, but he also could not serve as a United States Senator from Illinois. And therefore, his salary and benefits totaling over $1 million should go back to the U.S. Treasury. Now, that's significant. Now, the judge walks out at the hearing and says, at the closed hearing, first off, it's a sealed case, so the doors to the courtroom are locked. The windows in the back are covered. We have a sealed case. The judge comes out and says, Mr. Berg, I want you to understand with whatever argument you're going to put forth that I will have no input whatsoever on that because the D.C. Court of Appeals has stated I don't have input. And at the end of your presentation, the Attorney General's Office and Department of Justice will make a decision on what to do with this case. I said, well, I respectfully, listen to Your Honor, but I disagree, because the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and that's out in California, they've already said that judges should have input. And my statement to the judge is, why would the statute provide for a hearing if the judges have no input? He did not respond, but that's my position. But on our motion now that the case is unsealed, I can talk about it. Also, I have asked a motion for reconsideration, saying that the head of the Department of Justice and the head of the Attorney General's office is Eric Holder, the Attorney General. And I'm saying we found a statute there, presented to the judge, and we're waiting for a hearing, that there's a major conflict of interest. Think about it. Eric Holder was on the campaign committee for Obama running for president. He was one of three individuals that selected Vice President Biden and reviewed other candidates. And now he's the Attorney General, which is the highest law enforcement officer in the state, who also advises the president. So if there ever was a conflict of interest, that's it. So I'm asking them to turn the case over to me as the relator, or to have a special prosecutor appointed either to review this matter or to handle the entire matter.
So all right, Phil.
We're waiting for a hearing on that.
All right. We'll keep in touch and keep on top of this. Obamacrimes.com.
Yes.
And I wish you luck, but I got to say that if they, whoever they might be, some powerful group, can put an imposter in the White House, surely they can pay off some judges to make sure that the case never sees the light of day. Let me again reiterate, I can't emphasize it enough. I hope I'm wrong. I know that you do. I would love to be caught up in the euphoria and the optimism that his election brought, but perhaps I'm too cynical. Anyway, Phil, good talking to you. Thanks for joining me on the maiden voyage here of the
Richard,
conspiracy
show.
One
more point for your listeners, real quick. Why has Obama spent over $1 million fighting my three lawsuits and all the other lawsuits at this point if he has nothing to hide? You don't spend $1 million if you're legit.
That's an excellent question, and we'll just
back any time, and if there's ever callers, I'll be glad to answer any questions. And Phil Berg, it's obamacrimes.com, and good luck with your new show.
I appreciate it, Phil. We'll be in touch. And
Thank you.
We'll leave that question out there for people to wrap their heads around that.
I don't want to be a tiger, cause tigers play too rough. I don't want to be a lion, cause lions ain't the kind you love enough. But as I want to be your teddy bear.
Eliza Alice Presley joins me on the line from Memphis in Graceland, as a matter of fact. Eliza, thank you so much for being with me tonight.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. I'm just curious, why would you be attending the candlelight vigil for someone that you contend is still very much alive?
I'm not attending it for my brother because of the fact that he's not here and, you know, he didn't really pass away in 77. So, no, there's no mourning on my part. But by doing this, I'm able to turn around and pay my respects to my dad and my grandmother, who actually are buried here in the Meditation Gardens of Graceland. So it's to pay my respects to Vernon and Minnie Mae. It's not to pay my respects to my brother because he's not here.
Let's dial back to October, November last year when a Tennessee judge actually found sufficient evidence to reopen the estate, in this case of Vernon Presley, because your contention is that you are Vernon's child. Can you please summarize the DNA evidence that was used in this hearing in late 2008?
Okay. Actually, I ended up obtaining DNA from a first cousin of Elvis's on the paternal side back in 1999, but it wasn't until I had a cancer scare in 2000 that I went ahead and sent it to a lab and wanted to see, because I wasn't, the only thing I was trying to ascertain is I was trying to find out if he was actually my biological father. And so I turned around and I sent that in, and it was kind of a jumping off point. It was either, you know what, you're way off in left field and there's nothing to this, or you're going to be related and there's something, you know, to my suspicions. So basically, when that came back, it showed that she and I were very much related. And so that was the jumping off point that, you know, I wasn't crazy. And that was in the fall of 2000, and then I traveled to, you know, here to Memphis in March of 2001, and I met with his first cousin on the maternal side, on the Smith side. I met with his cousin and her mother, and I ended up getting her DNA, and then it was in 2007, I was actually told by a gentleman that I contacted that had the Elvis collection, and I was wanting to try to find out if he had any items that could possibly have DNA on it for testing. And he ended up telling me to contact a reporter at Fox 8 in Cleveland, and that she had an item that supposedly had his DNA on it, etc., but that she had also covered the whole Elvis is Alive story with back in 2002, I believe. So I actually, you know, when he told me, you know, when he told me that she was trying to find out or, you know, ascertain the person going by Jesse, that he was really Elvis Presley, to be honest, that was in July 2007, and I blew it off because I just didn't want to go down that road. It had nothing to do with what I was doing because I was just trying to find out if he was my dad. So I didn't do anything about it. And then in February of 2008...
Let me just jump in here if I could. And let me see if I understand this. You were adopted. You were trying to figure out who your father was. Friends had suggested to you that you had a striking resemblance to the Presley side of the family and that your children, in fact, looked like Elvis Presley. So you thought, well, listen, I'm trying to find out who my father is. You find out that your biological mother lived across from Graceland. You put two and two together and you thought, well, let's see if Elvis might be, in fact, your father. The DNA evidence, however, suggested something quite different, that Elvis was not your father, but Vernon Presley was your father, making Elvis your half-brother. This DNA evidence, that was this actually submitted to court in late 2008?
When I finally went ahead and got a hold of Suzanne Stafford at Fox 8 in Cleveland, Ohio, she told me about some DNA on a piece of blue jeans from an old piece of blue jeans from the late 60s, and supposedly it had blood stains on it. So anyway, I contacted her, and that's all I was contacting her about. Well, she told me it was cross-contaminated. They weren't even able to get a full DNA profile, and that there was actually several DNA profiles on it, male and female both, and that it was worthless. So it wouldn't have done me any good. So we start talking, and she goes on to tell me about this person going by the persona of Jesse that had submitted a cheek swab back in 2002. And, you know, I said, you know what, I've never belonged to, like, any Elvis conspiracy. I've never gone down the road, you know, did he really fake his death? So I was kind of ignoring it, to be honest. And she starts telling me everything that Fox did, trying to disprove that it was Elvis, and everything they did, they couldn't disprove it. And I found that was amazing. And then she explained to me that in 2002, he had done this cheek swab, and what happened is they had contacted Elvis's first cousins to try to get them to turn around and test against the sample from Jesse, because only Elvis Presley could sit there and match both sides of the family tree.
Let me just stop you there.
So
let me stop you there.
Was lined up to do that, and I don't know, they backed out, whatever the case may be. So all of a sudden, Fox had this DNA sample that had been extracted and profiled, but they had no one to test it against. They had no valid DNA. And I can tell you this much, it's extremely difficult to try to find valid Elvis Presley DNA. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's extremely difficult. So when she started telling me all the different things that led them to believe it was really him, I then told her that I had DNA from the first cousin on the Smith and Presley side, both the very thing they tried to get in 2002 and they couldn't.
Let me remind listeners, Eliza Alice Presley joining us on the line from Memphis, Graceland tonight. And Jesse Garon Presley, of course, is the or was the name of Elvis's stillborn twin brother. So the theory goes. So the idea here is that Elvis is living under his dead brother's name.
Yeah, he just, I know this sounds funny, but he just misspells it by one letter, and he usually puts it in quotation marks because he knows that he's not, you know, our brother Jesse Garon that died at birth.
And why would he choose his brother's name?
I totally get it, because I picture myself doing the same thing. And what he ended up doing is, I think despite the loneliness he had as an only child and the fact that he had been a twin but, you know, grew up without any siblings, grew up without a twin, I think he felt in a lot of ways that he felt guilty. The way that it's, and it's written in the book that he ended up doing in 2001 as well, but the way it's also been explained to me by several people very close to him is that Elvis Presley had 42 years on Earth. Okay, from 1935 to 1977. So what he wants to be able to do is he wants to be able to give his brother the same 42 years that he was afforded, so to speak. And he was literally able to turn around and just walk away from being Elvis Presley, which had to be extremely hard. It had to be easy in the respect that probably if he would have kept going the way he was, he really would have died. But he was able to walk away from it. And
for those not familiar with the backstory, in 2002, there was a physician in Independence, Missouri, I believe, Dr. Donald Hinton. I talked to him a number of times, who believed that he was treating Elvis Presley for various ailments and had DNA evidence to prove that this was, in fact, Elvis Presley, still alive and living again under an assumed name. And the book that came out was called The Truth About Elvis Aaron Presley, in his own words. Eliza, hold on. We'll be back in just a moment on the other side to discuss some more of the DNA evidence. Stay with us.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
We've reached Eliza Alice Presley. She's at Graceland attending the candlelight vigil for, well, not for Elvis. That would be hypocritical or ironic, I suppose, because she believes Elvis is alive. However, Elvira Alice Presley has, she says, DNA evidence to prove she is Vernon Presley's daughter, making her Elvis's half-sister. But further, she believes Elvis is, in fact, still alive. The judge in Tennessee last year certainly found enough compelling evidence to reopen the case. In other words, that you can prove you are Vernon Presley's daughter. But what about the evidence suggesting that Jesse Garon Presley is, in fact, Elvis? Is that DNA evidence as compelling?
Very compelling, because not only does Jesse match myself, but Jesse matches the Smith and Presley side. Jesse matches Elvis's first cousins on both sides of the family tree, Smith and Presley. Well, guess what? The only living person that's male that can match both sides of the family tree is Elvis.
Explain to me again, then, that the DNA evidence that came from Jesse. This was a swab taken from his inside his mouth, correct?
He actually, they filmed it. They have it documented, where they put together a cheek swab kit, DNA kit. Back in 2002, they had it marked. They filmed it. They did everything. They turned around and they sealed it up. They sent it to him, and he did the cheek swabs. He sent it back, and because it had all the same markings, they know for a fact that it was the same DNA kit. And when they turned around and extracted it, unfortunately, they did not have the first cousins to test against it like they hoped to.
So again, to clarify, Jesse Presley's DNA matched both sides of the family, not only his father's side, but his mother's side.
Yeah, exactly.
And only Elvis would be able to do that.
Only Elvis Presley can match both sides of Elvis's family tree. It's that simple. DNA doesn't lie. It doesn't have the capacity to.
Eliza Alice Presley on The Conspiracy Show, and she's at the candlelight vigil at Graceland as we speak. what sort of contact have you had with your brother Jesse, a.k.a. Elvis Presley?
Actually, after I got the DNA back last year and knew the truth and everything took a weird left turn and kind of being blindsided, I actually got in contact with an individual that is basically his go-between. It's the person listed in the book as Bern, B-E-R-N. Turned around and I sent a package to him. I put a really, really long handwritten letter. I told him who I was. I told him the background and everything. And it ended up being probably maybe 2 to 4 weeks later, then I got a call from Bern telling me that within that weekend that Jesse would be calling me, and sure enough, he did. Yeah, he ended up calling me late that night.
You spoke to Jesse on the phone. Did it sound like Elvis Presley?
Unfortunately, he uses a voice changer or a modulator, whatever you want to call it. And if you remember when everything came out with, God, forgive me for saying her name wrong, either Gail Giorgio Brewer or Gail Brewer Giorgio?
Yes.
When she did that book, what was the name of it? Is Elvis Alive?
Is he coming back or something? Yes, I remember, and she claimed to have had a telephone conversation with him.
Exactly, the cassette tape, okay? Well, she turned around and she bundled that tape with that book when she sold it.
Yes.
And even in that tape, she specifically admits that a brother of the person that works for Jeff, that he turned around and was going to call first, and that he asked specifically that she does not record anything, okay? And what her cardinal sin was, not only did she record it, which I think it would have been one thing if she would have kept it to herself for her own records or whatever, but she had it published and she put it with the book. And that was the last time that he turned around and made phone calls, and that was in October of 88, and that was the last time that he made phone calls without using the voice changer for that very reason when she did it. But that case, in fact, it was interesting because even when I spoke with him, you could hear the voice inflections, you could hear the wording that he used. It was absolutely him. There was no doubt in my mind, because there's things that come through even with the voice modulator.
All right. Has Jesse made it known to you whether he will, in fact, make himself known to you, whether he will present himself to you at some point?
Where he would do it, where he would meet me?
Yes.
I'm not sure how much of this I should say. I guess the easiest way to put it is that he tried. He was going to turn around and call me the following week when we hung up that night. And about what it amounted to is he ended up showing up at the address that he thought was mine. But I didn't live at that address. I just used it for mailing. And instead of calling me the following week, he ended up coming to where he thought I lived.
Give us quickly the status of your court case, because I understand you withdrew the case from that particular court in Tennessee. So give us an update on the court proceedings of this case.
Yeah, actually, I didn't drop my case like people think. I didn't drop my case last year, and it wasn't just missed from court or anything like that. I filed it in probate court because probate has to do with wills and heirship and all of that, right? So I filed it in probate court, unfortunately, which they did admit it, and they also did grant my petition, and they reopened Vernon's estate for the first time after 23 years. And unfortunately, we had to go ahead and let it be dismissed without prejudice, I think is the term, simply because they did not have the ability to decide on heirship, okay? Had I been included in Vernon's will already, then yes, it would have been the proper legal venue. But because I wasn't, they couldn't do anything. So what we did is either in December or January, we allowed it to be dismissed from probate court so that we could then turn around and refile in the proper court, or actually in a higher court that could make a determination. So anyway, we landed here this week, and I actually have refiled in court. I refiled my case as of yesterday.
Tell me a bit about the petition that you filed on Friday.
I was actually on my way back to the attorney's office. I had just left a plastic surgeon here in Memphis that I set up an appointment with, because my birth mother had made allegations after she saw the footage of me in the courthouse last year on October 8th, right?
Yes.
So she made allegations to another local channel here and spoke with a reporter later, saying that she was stunned and she was shocked at my appearance, and that it was obvious I had had major reconstructive or plastic surgery, implants, or whatever, to make myself look like the Presleys, to look like Vernon, to look like Elvis, that she was just stunned because she couldn't believe how much I looked like them. So what I did is I turned around and I paid my own money to do it, went to a plastic surgeon yesterday, and actually got a written statement where he said, I've never had anything done to my face, basically. So I felt good about that. And we were trying to hurry because we were down to a crazy deadline yesterday. We ended up having a race to the courthouse. We literally got there. The cutoff time was 4:30. We got there at 4:22 with 8 minutes to spare.
You're very confident in your DNA evidence, obviously. Do you believe that at the end of this court case, should you win, the media will get on board and actually declare that Elvis is alive?
Well, yeah, actually, no one's going to have a choice to, and the comment that was told, because there was someone that was very concerned about my court case coming out last year, and so basically what he told them is that he didn't care if the DNA was out there, and he didn't care if the truth was out there that he was alive, as long as no one knew his location.
Has he had surgery? Has he had reconstructive surgery?
Yeah, he has, but you can, in that book, there's a photo of him taken in 94 where he was with Lisa Marie's son, Benjamin. And he had had, you know, some work done.
How is his health? He's 74 years old.
We come to find out we share some health problems on the pain issues, and he definitely suffers from chronic pain, and he has issues with his back and spinal fractures from the karate and you know, all the shows that he did nonstop. He abused his body horribly. It's not what it amounts to. And I was told that, you know, he's had a couple, three different types of surgeries. I didn't really ask questions of what. And I know that he had a minor stroke in 2000 and, gosh, I want to say it had to be the end of 2001 or it was the beginning of 2002.
Does he still sing?
I know this is going to sound bizarre. I have never even ask him or thought to ask him, and it's because of the fact that I was looking for my family and I was adopted and I was trying to find, you know, out who my dad was after I met my real mother and everything. I don't think of him as Elvis like you or anybody else would, because to me, first, he's Jeff or Jesse, he's my brother, and he's family. I mean, my children are his only, you know, nieces and nephews, just all kinds of stuff. So I don't relate to him as Elvis, and it's never dawned on me to actually ask him that question. I would think he does simply because he enjoyed it so much, and he gave so much to his fans, and I know that he loved performing just from all the footage and everything that I've watched. I think it's just the whole lifestyle that he couldn't handle anymore, not because he wanted to just, you know, walk away because he didn't love his fans, because he did extremely much. He was supposed to go through with this, from what I understand. The planning for it started in 74. He was originally supposed to go through with it in 76, and he chickened out. I never asked why. And then finally did it, in, you know, toward the end of 77. And it had to be the hardest thing that he ever did, but yet it had to be easy at the same time, because he really just wanted a normal life. And being Elvis Presley, you don't get to just retire and hope you have a normal life. It wouldn't have happened.
All right, Eliza, I'll let you get back to the vigil where you can pay respects to your late father, Vernon, and your grandmother. But, of course, you're not there to mourn Elvis, because he is, in fact, still walking this earth as Jesse Garon Presley. Eliza Alice Presley, I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Richard. And, yeah, I wish you a good night. Appreciate it. And good luck on your new show.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Live from Toronto, Canada, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Good to have you aboard the maiden voyage here 550 Queen Street East in Toronto the Good. Dan Ellison flying this spaceship and taking your calls. He's your concierge, really. And my mentor, financial advisor, and only friend. We are going to talk about the swine flu for the next hour. It's really, I believe, the big story as we head into the fall. Because if this continues to mirror the swine flu of 1918, as we are repeatedly told, it is a mirror image. Of course, it came around in the spring and will then sort of lie low in the summer, which it did. Certainly the media stopped talking about it. And then it'll come back with a vengeance in the fall, as it did in 1918, this time a far more virulent strain. And it may come back again and again and again to bite us in the behind. Now I'm hearing reports that the World Health Organization has issued a binding recommendation. Isn't that a bit of a contradiction in terms? It's like mandatory volunteerism. A binding recommendation to all member countries requiring them to institute mandatory vaccination programs. Under an existing multilateral agreement, this formally invokes each state's pandemic plan and puts coordination under control of the World Health Organization. I don't know about you, but that scares me, chills me to the bone. All right. Is this, in fact, the big one? Is it a legitimate pandemic, or is it some sort of psychological warfare experiment being perpetrated I suppose by the agents of the New World Order. We're going to discuss this for an hour. Your participation is strongly encouraged. It's not a binding recommendation, but I think you'll want to get involved. Along with, they call him the King David of Natural Healing versus the Goliath of slash burn and poison medicine. Dr. Len Horowitz is an internationally known authority in the overlapping fields of public health, behavioral science, emerging diseases, natural healing, and the author of a number of fantastic best-selling books, including Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola, Healing Codes of the Biological Apocalypse, DNA Pirates of the Sacred Spiral. On and on it goes. Busy man, and we're happy to have him aboard the Conspiracy Show. Len, how are you?
Oh, great, Richard. Such a great pleasure to join you.
All right, and I'll also have you say hello to the second member of our panel here tonight. I like to call her the lab gal. Dr. Patricia Doyle is a retired doctor of veterinarian medicine. She holds a Ph.D. in Business Administration and Tropical Agricultural Economics from the University of the West Indies. And these days, she spends her days riding her motorcycle in upstate New York, rehabilitating injured deer on her farm. But she's also dedicated her life to researching and tracking emerging diseases and viruses, especially zoonotic diseases such as avian influenza and arthropod-borne illnesses. Dr. Patricia Doyle, welcome to you.
Well, Richard, congratulations on your premier event. And I was listening here in upstate New York, and you sound great.
I appreciate it. This is one, this signal, I tell you, at AM 740, just it takes no prisoners. It kicks butt and takes no prisoners.
It's a monster. That has been my station for quite a while. I love the music, and I've been listening, and I do want to say hello to my friend Len, Dr. Horowitz. I am so in awe of this man. He has connected all the dots, and he's just great.
All right.
He got all his ducks in a row, and when Len speaks, you know.
Let me get both of your reactions to this story. Len, you first. The World Health Organization issuing a binding recommendation to all member countries requiring them to institute mandatory vaccination programs. I think I know what you're going to say.
Well, first of all, I do want to say hi, Patricia. It's such a great pleasure to join you also. And then, Richard, yes, indeed, congratulations on your new show.
Thank you.
May it be a complete blessing for you and your listeners.
All right. This World Health Organization binding recommendation, your thoughts?
You know, sadly, this is, as you have been following for many years, a extension of the Rockefeller's plan. You know, first of all, what are the links to Rockefeller and emerging diseases in the World Health Organization? First of all, the United Nations is created. It was built in the United States by Rockefeller family. Rockefellers have been at the forefront of the cancer industry, basically the military, medical, petrochemical, pharmaceutical cartel for about the last 100 years. And that beyond that, this disease surveillance outposts that track these flus and these new emerging diseases, it was all set up by the Rockefellers and the Rockefeller Foundation. This was many years ago when I published the book Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola. I made sure that people knew about that. And the reality is that the new pandemic that has evolved has emerged out of laboratories. It's man-made. It's basically to advance a financial agenda, which is essentially profiteering off of humanity's suffering, which is the classic definition of genocide. And so we have genocide masquerading under the guise of public health in the United States that is profiting the Rockefeller family mainly, along with the drug industrialists and the vaccine industrialists that are likewise allied in one cartel, and that the World Health Organization is just virtually like you could consider the Gestapo. And through the United States and the FDA and the CDC and the policy administrators that are positioned into states and state agencies by CDC, we have a top-down direction of not just legislation, statutory law that violates the United States Constitution and has therefore really no substantive basis in law. It is simply a psychological operation and fear induction that is causing people to comply with these fascist totalitarian objectives of the Rockefeller and Rothschild and George Soros, the people that control the Genito pharmaceutical industry, the people, the same people that want to reduce world's population by half, and they're using their arm, the World Health Organization, to allegedly mandate. So you notice the language. Read that language again, Richard.
All right. Now, let me see. It says, now you've caught me off guard. I've closed it. Here it is. The World Health Organization has issued a binding recommendation to all member countries requiring them to institute mandatory vaccination programs under an existing multilateral agreement. This formally invokes each state's pandemic plan and puts coordination under control of the World Health Organization. For some European...
Okay, so the word recommendation, that means it has no definitive mandate. So it's an oxymoron. It's a mandated nothing is what it amounts to. And the states, again, you're dealing with jurisdiction, first of all. If you're going to have a mandate, then you have to have the, you have to be in the jurisdiction. If I was a federal employee or I was in the military and I signed my life on the dotted line, I'd lose my jurisdiction and sovereignty to exempt. But the truth of the matter is that the Constitution for the United States is still applying. And it states you have life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, and that if the government is going to take your property, that is, in this case, if the government is going to inject, infect, intoxicate, and mutilate your immune system, they're going to steal your immune system, God's given gift to keep humanity safe and healthy. It's going to take that, steal that, and inject, intoxicate that for allegedly public health and safety against flu. Well, if they're going to do that, according to the United States Constitution, they must, I mean shall, no ifs, ands, or buts about it, apply compensation or provide equitable, reasonable compensation.
Okay, Len, I've got to step away here. Stay tight. And also, Dr. Patricia Doyle on the line, stay with us as well. I'll get your take on this binding recommendation from the World Health Organization. But to all of you listening, something wicked this way comes, the swine flu. We are told this is the big one. Do you believe it? Or do you think this is some sort of psychological warfare experiment? Back with more. Stay with us.
Curiosity? Or did the devil make you do it? Whatever the reason, welcome back to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740. To talk to Richard, call 416-360-0740 or toll free in Ontario at 1-866-740-4740.
Dr. Len Horowitz and Dr. Patricia Doyle, the lab gal, on the line talking swine flu and their reaction to the World Health Organization's binding recommendation that states and jurisdictions ramp up for some sort of mandatory vaccination program. Dr. Patricia Doyle, over to you. To jab or not to jab?
Well, Richard, they certainly are revving up. This swine flu, though, is on a par with seasonal flu at this time. And I just wanted to bring this little matter up, that the vaccine, and this has been known, in fact, letters have gone out in July, 15th of July, we're going back to neurologists around the globe. And they are warning neurologists to be on the lookout for very serious neurological disease, Guillain-Barré syndrome. And we know that this would be associated with swine flu vaccination. We know in 1976 that this was the case, back in 76, when there wasn't even a swine flu. I believe one recruit had died and another recruit had contracted swine flu, but I believe that was from the vaccines that the recruits were given. So with two cases of swine flu, the government made a major outbreak, and people like myself went out and took the vaccination. I was sick for 3 months, and my concern has been that the vaccine companies are going to pass this 1976 vaccine on to the public, maybe not the same vaccine in the vials, but they are probably going to make a carbon copy of that vaccine. And with these letters that have gone out to the neurologists to be aware of cases of GBS, that tells me that this vaccine is not safe. And the World Health Organization, as Len can tell you, they intend to start jabbing people. And Greece has already said that they are going to vaccinate each and every citizen in their country. So this indeed is getting quite scary.
Dr. Doyle, you and I had talked about this before. I asked you directly at that time whether you thought that H1N1, or this strain, was in fact engineered in a lab. You've heard Dr. Horowitz. He's quite emphatic that it is. Have you changed your mind, or do you still believe this is a naturally occurring influenza?
Richard, I don't know. I have here an article that I sent you from a Bloomberg article, and here we have a noted scientist, Dr. Adrian Gibbs, who collaborated on research that led to the development of Tamiflu, and he seems to his research, and he looked at the sequence, tells him that he believes that this swine flu was actually indeed created in a lab, that it was during vaccine research that it had mutated within the eggs and had spread to the pigs that were infected. I don't know. I looked at the some of the sequence. We know that these viruses have been circulating in swine. I sent you another article about another case now in Kansas. This is just too many coincidences. Now we have the case of a child that has come down with a virus, an H3N2, that has not been found in humans before. This one is a swine flu virus peculiar to pigs, and it has been circulating in North America. Richard, virtually all of the outbreaks, pandemics, and the outbreaks of influenza start in Asia, whether it's East Asia or Southeast Asia. They start in the East. This swine flu combined with the 1918 flu, began in North America. All of this adds up to a lot of credence in what Dr. Horowitz is saying.
Well, Len, what is it? Is it the sequencing, or is it the speed at which this flu was mutating earlier on that has convinced you that it has been engineered?
Both, because the rate of mutation, the speed of mutation is based on the genetic sequences, because when you cut and splice and paste and use reverse genetic engineering, which is what they're using for these flu vaccines, they're actually reversing from old pieces of genetic material, new pieces, and when you put them together, they're not like they've been together for millennia, like a natural virus. It's obviously man-made, because what happens is that those combining points are unstable. And because those splicing points are unstable, they break apart more rapidly and they mutate. Therefore, when it jumps from one person to the next, far, 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 far more. I mean, way statistically significant, like no possibility you could have anything but a laboratory mutant. So this is the science that Dr. Gibbs and others have brought to bear, and Patricia is completely correct. This really heavily indicates that this is a laboratory outbreak.
Hold on. All right.
Not an accident.
Okay, we'll get to some calls when we come back. Dr. Len Horowitz, Dr. Patricia Doyle, Something Wicked This Way Comes.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
All right, welcome back. Dr. Len Horowitz on the line, and Dr. Patricia Doyle as well, as we talk about swine flu. Let's go to the phones, and we'll pick it up in Niagara Falls and say hello to Doreen. Doreen, welcome.
Welcome back, Richard. I can't keep a good man off the radio.
Well, good to have you aboard as well. And
I know. We think you're fantastic. By the way, I'd like to thank Dr. Doyle and Dr. Horowitz for revealing the truth. It's following the money, and what it is that these certain people high up, whether it's Bilderbergers or whatever, it's the One World Order, it's a case of whom they decide should live or die. Do you agree or not?
Len, Patricia, whoever wants to jump in on that one.
I apologize, Richard. I could barely hear the caller from where I'm sitting.
Well, essentially, Doreen is saying that what this amounts to are very powerful individuals deciding who gets to live and who gets to die. So this is a part of a major depopulation agenda.
That's exactly what it is. And what's happening is this is a psychological operation that's necessary to conduct this kind of genocide, this depopulation. It's according to the standard military textbooks. I mean, it's standard. You need to have these mass-mediated frights and population manipulations in order to get intoxications through vaccinations. That's what you've got to give. That's what's called non-lethal warfare. It's all written up in the War College, U.S. War College's Revolution in Military Affairs, and the conducting of non-lethal warfare, which is a misnomer. It kills people slowly. These viruses and the drugs that are provided to, like Tamiflu, to combat the flu. There's Donald Rumsfeld from Gilead Science Corporation, and he's also the guy who is behind the aspartame sweeteners. This is profiteering off of humanity's suffering because they're intoxications, they're drugs, and combinations of drugs which weaken the immune system and biological agents is the number one way in which non-traceable, non-lethal warfare, biological weaponry and biochemical weaponry is now advanced by the military. It is the standard warfare, biological and biochemical warfare, that has been tested so well, Richard. They know precisely how many people are going to die from these exposures. They've got it all nailed down. If you would read the population material that's put out by Battelle Memorial Institute and the population volumes that deal with how do you manage populations, and is put out by the same people that virtually created the anthrax that was mailed, the Battelle Memorial Institute.
World Health Organization is warning 2 billion infections within 10 years. Your thoughts on that, Dr. Doyle?
Well, I have to concur with Dr. Rowan said. And, of course, if people are weakened through vaccines and also... I have at my fingertips, Richard, a list starting at 1931 of bio-war events that have been perpetrated on innocent civilians and also on some of the military with and without their knowledge, and that would be just continuing the trend. They know how many people will die. And, that's about it. I totally concur with what Glenn said.
This vaccine supposedly is to contain an adjuvant called squalene, which is I understand, similar to your natural tissue. So what is squalene? Why do they put it in the vaccine, and what are the concerns there?
Well, it's a natural protein, and it's much like the studies that were engaged in producing the human chorionogonadotropic hormone, that's a mouthful, HCG for short. In essence, it's the female pregnancy hormone that as a hormone and a protein basically it basically fools the immune system, and that it causes the immune system to mount an attack against the real protein. So women who get pregnant, they secrete HCG. But if you've been injected with HCG from vaccinations, which is what they did, and in fact, your number one president of the United States science director, science czar, John Holdren, has actually come out in a co-authored book years ago that talked about depopulation and population reduction using injections, vaccinations, intoxications, and that's what they administered with the tetanus vaccine in hundreds of thousands of women in the United States, mostly in the black community, which is why now your 25% to 30% of your black women in urban America are sterile. You have about the same number in native North American women are sterile. And in the Philippine population, they're likewise, that percentage is sterile because of the vaccinations. Now, you've even had the Roman Catholic Church come out, oppose this type of population inoculation for population reduction, you know? And so this is birth control, or it is a kind of intoxication. When it comes to squalene, it uses the same kind of mechanism whereby instead of basically attacking the normal HCG, it attacks the protein, the actual squalene that is produced by the human being, because the injection of foreign squalene is significantly different, but it's similar, so that the immune system recognizes it as foreign. And it's just like Dr. Doyle talked about earlier, the Guillain-Barré, which, in fact, I don't know if Patricia remembers this, but my mother died of that vaccine and that precise injury. And it's basically the same as the squalene, because in Guillain-Barré, your white blood cell bodyguards in the immune system get fooled by the injection of the foreign proteins, just like in squalene, it's a foreign protein, or in HCG, it's a foreign protein. And so the immune system of my mother, once she got injected with the swine flu, her own white blood cell bodyguards began to attack and destroy her own proteins. And the scientists and the immunologists call the cause what's called an antigenic complex. That's made of like what you've got injected with combined with your own body part. And that's what fools the immune system, because it can't recognize self from non-self.
So this is why this particular strain of a swine flu, they're warning us, is going to be so deadly on people otherwise in the prime of their life, not necessarily immune compromised. Those, you know, young, able-bodied adults. Is that the case? Because it's the immune system, basically a healthy immune system, is going to be working overtime and attacking a healthy body.
Yes, the basically right now the entire population is under attack. There's no question in my mind. And yet there's these foolish recommendations that have been issued by the World Health Organization as though they were really total proponents of population reduction. For example, pregnant women have been singled out as to receive this mercury squalene-laden dose of toxins. And so why would you do that? I mean, anybody in medicine, I mean, we bend over backwards to not do anything potentially harmful to this mother and this fetus, which is neurologically developing. Imagine injecting mercury, the most neurotoxic substance on planet Earth, into this mother who's giving life a chance. And this is what they call public health. This just goes to show, I mean, Richard, this is standard, like Hitlerian propaganda. You tell a lie long enough, eventually we believe this truth, said Joseph Goebbels.
All right, let's go back to the
propaganda minister.
Let's go back to the phones.
The greater the lie, the more stupid sheep will go into the slaughter, are going to buy into it. And this is the case with giving babies, 12-hour-old infants, hepatitis B vaccines in hospitals. It's the same thing as now we're going to inject mercury and aluminum and formaldehyde and formalin into these mothers who are bearing, you know, fetuses. This is absolutely disgusting.
All right.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, but first let me do this, because, you know, despite what you've said, Len, it behooves me to have people, you know, consult their physicians, because this is obviously is a delicate medical issue. And now I've covered that off nicely. I've squared that away. Dr. Doyle, go ahead, and then we'll get to the phones.
Yeah, when I wanted to ask Len, do you think that, because there has been a surge in mild retardation, developmental delays. My own daughter is mildly retarded, and I can't help but wonder, I see this surge in cases. Do you think that that's a result of all these vaccines?
There's two things that are going on here, Patricia. One of them is, yes, medical genocide and intoxication, and that's for the general autistic spectrum population. The children who are autistic and have these other learning disabilities, attention deficits, hyperactivity disorders, these kinds of neurological impairments are definitively linked. You look at Wakefield studies, you look at numerous other studies that the government, the genocidalists, do not want to look at, but yet there's a ton of science, very, very excellent science. And, of course, you know, there's a ton of science from mercury dental mercury, and all the there have been countries like Sweden that have banned dental mercury. So this is the same thing. We have the Food and Drug Administration, the American Dental Association, the American Medical Association, all Rockefeller puppets and drug cartel drug pushers. They're essentially then now intoxicating our children. And what are they showing us on television? They're giving you the whole agenda. In a 60-second ad, they give you 10 seconds of all the toxic side effects that you can expect to get from all the toxic drugs that they want to give you as normal life.
All right, let's go to the phones. And a gentleman or a lady standing by wishing to be known as a doctor, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Richard, very good to hear your voice again invading the radio.
Thank you. Your question, comment for Dr. Doyle or Horowitz?
I was just going to bring up the fact that recently there's been a lot of legislation passed preparing for civil unrest and whatnot, and that is directly related to people who are going to be refusing to take the vaccine.
And how do you know this?
Just things I've been reading on the internet, like preparing for civil unrest, possible upheaval, that sort of thing.
That's true. I have an article here. I believe it was in Maine, the National Guard. They've been drilling at a high school up there, and that is to prepare for possible H1N1. Now, it's not for them handing out medicine. Of course, they're preparing for civil unrest. You know, going back to vaccine, the virus can also mutate within the vaccine. Now, in the case of polio, we just had another major outbreak of polio in Nigeria because of the virus mutating. And what happens is people get vaccinated with the polio vaccine, and then they get polio, and the polio then is just as contagious as though it was a wild type.
All right, let me bring this back, if I could, to the swine flu, because I'd in the future, obviously, we can do a show dedicated to strictly vaccines. But let me ask you, in September, let's assume for a moment that the World Health Organization has not dropped the other shoe and we're not going to be mandated to receive vaccinations. What are we supposed to do? Who are we supposed to believe? Should we stay home? Should we keep our kids out of public school and daycare? Should we wear masks on the subways? What do we do?
Oh, boy, Richard, that's a great question, and I think that nobody really has a complete answer for that. There have been a number of people that have written, journalists written some suggested scenarios, but nobody's got the crystal ball except the people at the highest level of government. If I had to call it, I would say that the urgency that they're going to create, I'd say that there's a really great possibility, probably a 60 to 75% probability that the government, Central Intelligence Agency, which has been working in biological weaponry and advancing these types of outbreaks, such as the anthrax mailing, that they're going to do something extraordinary, and that that extraordinary urgency is going to create this fear, and the government is then going to step in and, of course, be Johnny-on-the-spot saviors as they were down in New Orleans with the hurricane down there, Katrina, of course, you see FEMA's response, you see the Fed response to these kinds of urgencies. You're going to see total chaos, devastation, destruction, and population reduction. And so this is what I think there's a great likelihood, but the main, I have to repeat this, if you're listening tonight, you would have to be completely stupid to go get vaccinated. Do whatever you can, and you tell everybody that you love and you care for to run as far away as people can possibly get from anybody that comes up to your door bearing vaccinations. Now, according to several articles, the social services departments are going to be assisting as deputies for the health commissioners and health departments that are going to come knocking on people's doors with three flu vaccines. And so the administration of this, I think, as what Patricia Doyle just said and what the caller requested information on, is you have actually this week running nationally, the National Guard is hiring, they tell us, for escorts for people to be escorted under armed guard to these kinds of facilities where they say quarantine is going to happen. Of course, if you really start to study the contracts, it's all Halliburton, who's been making the mass money fortunes for private investors from the Carlyle Group that includes the Bin Laden family and the Bush family, as well as top British and German investors. And you've got now the people set up for running the concentration camps are these private entities. So the caller's question, I think there's a great likelihood that what he's thinking is going to happen.
All right, listen.
And we're going to have a prayer session. I know Greg Ciola from the Crusader, who's been a real a maverick and a hero and a patriot and somebody who's trying to save lives. He's got a newspaper called The Crusader. He and I have talked recently about organizing for September a major global prayer so that we pray for coverage and protection from the angels of protection, because we don't know what's going to happen.
All right.
And only God knows.
I know what's going to happen right now. I'm going to take a break. But let me just tell people out there listening, I cannot sit in this chair, have access to this microphone, and tell you not to have the vaccine or to have the vaccine. You've heard what Dr. Len Horowitz has said. You've heard what Dr. Patricia Doyle has said. I urge you to go out, do your own research, ask questions, speak to your doctor, make your own decision. Let's all hope that we have that right to make our own decision. Back with more of the swine flu here on The Conspiracy Show.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
I don't know about you, but I'm sitting here scratching my head trying to figure out what's worse, the disease or the cure. Dr. Patricia Doyle is with us, the lab gal. She spends her days in upstate New York rehabilitating injured deer, riding her motorcycle, and tracking the coming plagues and emerging viruses. And, of course, Dr. Leonard Horowitz, the King David of natural healing, internationally known authority in the fields of public health, behavioral science, emerging diseases, and natural healing. Let's go back to the phones and say hello to Wog. Welcome to The Conspiracy Show. Hello.
Richard.
Hi there.
Good to be back on the air, sir.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Just wanted to say that you've got two great guests on tonight, and what Len was saying about staying in a good love vibration is very important, for sure. Like that national prayer thing, very important thing. But I wanted to raise the point of, I don't know if Dr. Horowitz is aware of Eleanor McBean's book called Vaccinations Condemned, talking about the 1918 flu pandemic that happened, the influenza pandemic. Basically what happened was the military and the public were massively inoculated, supposedly against all these diseases, and this. And Eleanor McBean and her family did not take the vaccination, as well as other people. But basically, the notion is that all those that took it got sick. And Eleanor McBean has the memory. She was actually a witness to the pandemic and said that her family were one of the only ones in her town that were going around taking care of sick people because they didn't take the vaccination. So I'm wondering if the similar thing is going to be happening with this one. And I'd like to hear my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, Dr. Doyle, we haven't heard from you in a while. Did you want to address that question?
Well, I haven't read the book, and I really have no information about any vaccinations during 1918 flu. So I will have to ask Glenn, do you know about it? I have no information on it, so I cannot comment.
You know, that's a book I haven't read, but I really need to read. Absolutely. Thank you very much for sharing that. It doesn't surprise me at all that the 1918 swine flu was caused, triggered by a vaccination program. You know, the first reference that's unbelievable, the totally amazing first reference comes from 1776 in a document that's been basically demonized as being today the most anti-Semitic document in the world. It's called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And as a Messianic Jew, I can tell you that I was very pleased to read that book, especially having graduated when I did back in the 1970s, when they were still teaching people to read and to read things that were racist or that were anti-Semitic, so that you can understand literature and you can understand psychological manipulations of the mind based on these kinds of promotions. At any rate, the first document in the United States, in the world that I'm aware of that talks about injecting people with diseases is this Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Now, that was around, again, came out initially about 1776, and subsequent to that, you have the people, the native North Americans, were given smallpox-laced blankets as gifts to spread to the native populations this disease. So that was certainly operating by the late 1800s. So you had already biological warfare operating then. And then the injections, I know that by 1918 there were already vaccinations that were being certainly used experimentally, and it wouldn't surprise me. I know that the military has been used, I think you mentioned it earlier, Patricia, as consistently throughout history, experimental guinea pigs for drug companies, and that the last large swine flu pandemic, allegedly, that broke out in 76 was supposedly breaking out in an isolated area of, I think it was New Jersey, where one of the military bases where injections had occurred. And so this is, again, something that I would love to read that book. I don't have that knowledge, but I would say that it's okay. Consistent with everything I'm looking at.
All right. I'm going to take another time out here. Let me just say, I have to be honest, Len, I'm very, very nervous about references to the document that you cited, the Prairie of Sion, because it has been in many, many, many quarters basically discredited. However, that's your take on it. I can't say that it's mine in terms of the validity of that particular document. It is a very, very contentious issue. It's an understandably very, very sore point with a lot of people. However, the other points that you made about the targeting of North American Indians and the smallpox virus, I certainly subscribe to much as that has been written and said about that. Dr. Doyle stays with us, Dr. Horowitz, and we'll take your calls as well. The swine flu, is it, in fact, the pandemic they've been warning against us about, a naturally occurring one, or is this some engineered psychological warfare experiment? Stay with us.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Certainly feels like the dark end of the street. Sounds like we are in the shadows, but it's time to start kicking holes in the darkness because we have something wicked coming this way. We are told, and again, if this swine flu is to mirror the 1918 swine flu, it's going to come back with a vengeance this fall. Dr. Patricia Doyle is with us, the lab gal, tracking emerging viruses around the world, and, of course, Dr. Len Horowitz. In September, again, let me ask you this question. What's your worst-case scenario? Let me ask you, Dr. Doyle, to begin with. Are we going to see, in 1918, of course, we had the funeral business was booming and we had funerals that lasted about, 15 minutes, and then they brought in the next one, and then the next one, and then the next one. It couldn't keep up. Is it going to be that bad?
Well, first of all, we, as the people, we can prevent it. This is one of the most important things that you can do, people out in radio land. Please, please, if you feel ill, do not go out in public. That alone can prevent a lot of the spread. If you feel, and you believe me, you know the difference between flu and cold. You feel as though you're coming down with the flu, and you begin, you have a temperature, and you just do not go out. Do not go to work. Do not pass the virus on. And I think that we can control a lot of the spread. And as you've heard a million times before, proper hand washing. Don't be embarrassed. If I go to the store in September and there's a lot of cases around me, I will use the latex gloves, surgical gloves, when I go. I don't think it's that perilous to use a mask, but I will use the surgical gloves or neatly disguise them with a pair of gloves over.
Dr. Horowitz, let me ask you, and I say this with all love and respect to my good friend Dr. Doyle, is she buying into the fear? Is she a useful fool?
Well, you know, I know Patricia Doyle for many years. She's a loving human being who does some great research and always comes up with some wonderful ideas with regard to the research that she conducts. So I don't have anything bad to say about Patricia. Frankly, she's a dear friend for years. The issue, I think she's, you know, very few people, Richard, lay it out all on the line like Dr. Len Horowitz does. you know, tonight you've been a little tentative about some of the things I've said, and I appreciate that because, you know, you're on a new radio show, and I support you completely in doing whatever you need to do to stay on because I love you. You are a great voice for freedom in the world, and I support everything that you do. But frankly, you know yourself, what I'm telling you in your heart is the way it is because I haven't lied to you in the 15 years I've known you. I haven't had 16 books, three bestsellers that have all predicted what's going on today. And I'll give you an example. A couple weeks ago, I got a call from Dr. Meir Eisenstein, who is likewise a hero. Years ago, after he heard me speak, he tells a story. He stopped giving his pediatric families and patients and his OBGYN also practice of home birthing. He stopped giving vaccines, and now he has 20,000 families with zero cases of autism. And he thanks me, and he says, Len, you've been vindicated recently. You know, we used to think you're radical. And today now, to look around to see what's happening, you were right on all the time. And so this is the thing that Patricia Doyle is saying. It's just common sense. It makes sense, but you've got to go to the next level. What is the government not telling you? They're not telling you about all the natural ways that you can prevent all this flu. You don't have to get worried. Essentially, there's vitamin D in megadoses. There's vitamin C in megadoses. There's oxysilver, which you know is my most fabulous absolute recommendation for anybody that wants to have a complete elimination from fear and the flu viruses is study silver hydrosols, the most advanced technology in infection control and in infection elimination, and it completely eliminates the need for vaccinations and toxic antibiotics, is the silver hydrosols. The top best-selling one is my favorite. It's called OxySilver. People can get information on OxySilver.com about that product. But the reality is there's many things that people can and should be doing to boost their natural immunity, and number one is stay away from toxicity. Watch what you're eating. Look at the chemicals in the foods. Drink a lot of pH 8 adjusted drinking water. Alkalize your body, because if you alkalize your body, the germs can't grow. And so there's very simple things that have been neglected by the public health. They call themselves public health experts and officials. They're actually genocidalists. They're Manchurian candidates given a license to kill and propagandize genocide under the guise of what they preach. You know, the reality is you're on your own, folks. And you've got to discern what is in your best interest based on the truths that you hear from various people. And the best connection that you can have is that divine connection in your own heart. And you've got to do your own due diligence to get to the point where you can make an informed choice.
All right.
So it's a combination of what you know and what's in your heart. Follow that.
Dr. Len, I'll direct people to a website I think that'd be very interested in, and that is www.fluscam.com, FLUscam.com. And I thank you, as always, for your participation. And obviously, this is going to be a huge story for the foreseeable future. So I look forward to our next conversation with you. Thank you, Len. And Dr. Doyle, of course, you know that I absolutely said what I said with all due love and respect. I was simply trying to prod Len, but I don't think you're anybody's useful fool, and I couldn't do this program without you.
Thanks. And I think Len is great. I've always been in awe of him. His credentials are impeccable. We have a Harvard graduate here.
All right.
And I do, I think that what he said is so important. And, take your vitamin D and do everything you can. And as you mentioned previously, it's a personal decision that people have to make.
Yes, we can't make it for them.
They have to talk to their doctors and weigh the benefits and risks.
Thank you, Dr. Doyle. Always a pleasure. We'll talk again soon. Listen, friends out there, I hope you enjoyed my first offering and the first of many, many more here on AM 740. Thanks to Dan Ellison. And back next Sunday at 11 o'clock, Victor Vigiani from Exopolitics Canada. We'll talk about some of the latest information on Roswell, the UFO crashed 60 years ago, and more. We'll also talk to Rosemary Ellen Guiley, a paranormal investigator. She's trapped the voices of ghosts on tape. And we'll hammer away at the Elvis story one more time. I'll talk to a forensic investigator who has some more information on this DNA evidence. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light, and what I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.